Exegeting Controversy Passages by Robert C. Newman, the Biblical Theological Seminary. Brief abstract. Here we look at those narratives or discourses which can be categorized as controversies. What do we look for in such passages? We work through a few samples, the calling of Matthew, paying taxes to Caesar, the debate over resurrection, the dispute between Mary and Martha. What are controversy passages? Well, they can be either narrative, Jesus responding in dialogue fashion to an opponent, or they can be discourse, report of Jesus' speech dealing with a controversial subject. In either case, there are certain things to look for or think about so as to be sure we don't misunderstand what is going on. What do we look for? Well, the first thing we need to realize is that Jesus may not be addressing the particular controversy you're concerned about, even though it may sound like it at first. After all, his first concern is the controversy that is going on in his own time. Thus, you need to see what that controversy is about. Secondly, you need to think about who are Jesus' opponents and where are they coming from ideologically in regard to this particular controversy in the background that they might have that would influence how they see that. The third thing to look for is what is Jesus' view of this matter that is being debated in his time? And then, sort of methodologically, how is Jesus arguing for his position? Remember, his opponents, particularly if they're not followers of his, do not accept his claims. So they're not about to take his word for it. So in trying to learn something about how we argue for a position, we need to see how Jesus argues for his position, since our opponents will typically not accept our claims and not take our word for it. Also under how is Jesus arguing for his position, we ask ourselves, can we understand his words as actually arguing from where his opponents are to where he is? Is he reaching out to them and seeking to bring them over to where he is? We need to realize that Jesus may leave out some steps in his argument that would be easily understood by his original audience or opponents. In most any situation of this sort, one's background will influence how they understand the argument, and one can leave out steps if your audience can be understood to handle that. When I was in grad school and reading articles in physics and astrophysics, our journal articles would typically leave out lots of steps that a person who was either didn't have a physics background or who wasn't into this particular field might not be able to follow immediately, and you'd have to sit down and think through how to get from one equation to another equation where the person has left out all the steps that would be put there if you were in a classroom and a teacher were working you through it. We did similar situations of that sort. Jesus is often arguing with the rabbis and is operating then in terms of their knowing their own background and their own assumptions and methods of argumentation and that sort of thing. And it does not follow that we will understand Jesus' argument unless we can supply these steps that have been left out. Then, fourthly, once we understand what Jesus is saying to his original opponents and to his original audience, we're now ready to see how this carries over to us and to situations we face today. So you can see here the basic idea is you need the background of Jesus and his opponents to help you understand what he's arguing for in that particular situation. And once you've got a good handle on that, then you can begin to carry that over and apply that to situations we face today, which may be similar in certain ways but are bound not to be identical. Well, what kind of controversy and dialogue accounts do we find in the Synoptics? Here in our Synoptic Gospels course, we gave a list of passages that more or less fall into this genre in the Synoptics. One of them, the controversy involving John the Baptist rather than Jesus. The rest of them involve Jesus in one way or another. We'll not go through that here. But we're going to look at a few of these in what follows. First of all, we want to look at the calling of Matthew in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. Now, if you'll turn to that particular location, we'll have a look at that. Here's what it looks like. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Matthew was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Well, we ask ourselves, first of all, who are Jesus' opponents here? And the answer is the Pharisees. And that term in modern English parlance means something like hypocrites. Although there were certainly people in antiquity who thought the Pharisees were hypocrites, that's not what the word meant in ancient Jewish world, where Jesus is actually operating as a particular group of Jews who felt that the average Jew was awfully slack on observing the law, and that that was one of the reasons why the Israelites were not doing so well as one would hope, that they were currently in a situation in which their land was governed by the Romans rather than by themselves, and that they felt that if Jews would just get on it and seek to do their best to please God, that God would then intervene and rescue them from their opponents. So that's the Pharisees. Very quick tour. There's a lot more to be said about it. What are they concerned about? Well, they're concerned that Jesus is keeping bad company. And like many religious people throughout history, they felt that one of the ways to really get messed up is to keep bad company. And the Bible gives them support to that, by the way. And so that's their concern here. Jesus can't very well be setting a good example when he's keeping the bad company, when he is eating with these tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors have probably never had a great reputation anywhere in history, but they obviously do better in our society, where they are appointed by elected officials and are not supposed to collect anything but the taxes that we have somehow, or by representatives that voted on, etc. But in the society we're looking at Jesus' time, the Romans have decreed the taxes, or their puppet rulers, Herod and such, and the taxes are not being spent as well as the taxpayers would like, if you like. And so tax collectors were viewed as a scum, as worse than a used car salesman, we might say, or such. And definitely were not good company. Sinners was a euphemism of some sort for other types of people, harlots and such, that also were considered bad company by the Pharisees. Well, how does Jesus answer his opponents in this particular situation? Well, he answers by using an analogy of sin to sickness. He'd say, I am doing for sin and sinners what a doctor would do for sick people and for sickness. And he uses an Old Testament citation out of Hosea 6:6. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. So, how is Jesus answering them? He's basically saying, just as it is reasonable to imagine that doctors, physicians, would be found consorting with sick people because that's the way they heal them, so you should not be surprised that I am consorting with bad company because I've come to try and help them. He cites the passage in Hosea, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," which, by the way, is not to be taken that God had no interest in sacrifice, but that that God's purpose was a redemptive purpose. It wasn't that you could rack up points for bringing sacrifices, but that sacrifice was a concession to the fact that you're sinners, and that, in a sense, sacrifice was putting a substitute in your place that would pay for your sin, if you like, the sacrificial animal. And then Jesus himself closes this by summarizing his mission. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. There's some irony there, I think, as we look over the rest of Jesus' teaching. The point I think he is making is already made in the Old Testament. There's none righteous, no, not one, etc. Having come to the human race, he has come to a group of sinners. And the Pharisees themselves are sinners as well as all these other people. And so Jesus has come to be with people who are bad company in order to call them back to God. Well, that's kind of a quick tour of the debate on calling Matthew. We're getting some feel of where the Pharisees were coming from and the fact that they felt that a part of righteousness was staying away from bad company was in contrast to Jesus' situation that all of us are bad company and that he's come to rescue us from that whole problem. Another controversy that we see Jesus engaged in is this one in Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 through 22, where we have the matter of paying taxes to Caesar. Here's what the controversy looks like. Then the Pharisees went out, the Pharisees again, and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose portrait is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then he said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." So when they heard this, they were amazed. They left him and went away. Well, we ask our same questions. Who are Jesus' opponents? And we have two of those groups here, the Pharisees and the Herodians. It's helpful to think a little bit about their background. The Pharisees we've already sketched a little bit, but the Pharisees were not very happy about the fact that the Jews were under Roman authority and that the Romans were ruling typically through puppet kings and governors. The Herodians we don't know much about, but the name itself means advocates or followers of the Herods, and so presumably these would be Jewish people as well, but they would be people who stood to gain from the particular form of government that currently existed, in which members of the Herod family had some political authority. And so typically the Pharisees would not be happy with paying taxes to Caesar, and the Herodians would at least be happy that taxes were being paid because they were making something off of those taxes. What are the opponents trying to do? Well, the text tells us they're trying to trap Jesus into saying something disastrous about taxes. And I think what we see here is that the Pharisees, trying to trap Jesus, have gotten one set of their opponents, the Herodians, to come, so that if Jesus answers one way, the Pharisees will be able to get him into trouble, and if he answers another way, the Herodians will be able to get him into trouble. They want Jesus to say, on the one hand, yes, you should pay taxes, and then the Pharisees can go spread that among the people who certainly do not like paying taxes. Or, no, you should not pay taxes, and then the Herodians could go pass that on to the Roman governor Pilate and would get Jesus into very serious trouble as well. So trying to get Jesus to say something disastrous about taxes. How did Jesus respond? Well, Jesus' response is very, very clever. He is able to do something that gets the Pharisees and the Herodians to trip themselves up, or the Pharisees particularly, and he is able to say something in a very short, what we might say, soundbite, that is in fact very, very deep, very basic sort of thing that helps us to understand the relationship between God and government, the relationship between our responsibilities to God and government. First of all, Jesus gets them to provide the coin. Show me the coin of the used for paying the tax, he says in verse 19. And they provide the coin. That means they've got the coin and they've been using the coin. So any claims that somehow, sinful to use the coins would be hypocrisy on the part of the Pharisees or the Herodians. Well, in a sense then, once they've provided the coin, the rest is easy, though we might not see in advance how to get there. In retrospect, we can see it. Jesus gets them to point out what's on the coin. And in fact, on a denarius of this period, when Tiberius was the emperor, etc., it would have a picture of Tiberius on the front side. We have lots of these coins. And then a picture on the back that we're not entirely sure who it is. Some think it is Tiberius's mother. Some think it's an allegorical figure of some sort. But there's an inscription on the front and back. The front inscription basically shows us that the Emperor Tiberius made a claim to be the son of the divine Augustus. So it has some problematical theological claims on it. The inscription on the back shows that Tiberius made a claim to be the high priest, if you like, not the high priest of the Jewish religion, but the high priest of the Roman religion, Pontifex Maximus, if you like. So the fact that they're carrying this thing around shows that their theological scruples are not real serious. They don't like to pay the taxes. Well, given that this has Caesar's name on it, etc., it's clearly Caesar's property. And then Jesus can basically point them to the Old Testament provision that they are to give their borrowed property back to the owner. And that's what he says then. Well, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give back to God what is God's. And by setting it up in this way, raises the question of, you don't give Caesar what belongs only to God, but you do give Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And tax is part of what belongs to Caesar. God does not set up the arrangements in Scripture so that we are allowed to second-guess the government at every turn, which in fact is what most of us in the United States do and what our newspapers do left and right. We have a responsibility to obey the government, and only when the government commands us to do something God has forbidden, or when the government forbids us to do something God commands, are we to disobey the government. And the question of paying taxes is not, in fact, one of those sorts of things. Right following this is another controversy relating to marriage and the resurrection that occurs in Matthew chapter 22, verses 23 through 33. That same day, the Sadducees, who say they know resurrection, came to him with a question. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and have children from him, for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same happened to the second, third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? Jesus replied, You are in error, because you do not know the Scriptures, nor the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Well, who are Jesus' opponents here? Not the Pharisees or the Herodians, but the Sadducees, who deny the resurrection. Now, the Bible doesn't give us any more information on in what sense they denied the resurrection. And one might assume, well, since they were compromisers with the Greeks in one way or another, they denied it in the same way the Greeks did. They just believed in the immortality of the soul. That, however, is not correct. Josephus tells us that they believed that the soul dies with the body. That is, a person ceases to exist when they die. And so no more existence after that. Knowing what Josephus has to do, says about this, which is part of our historical background, gives us some insight into which way Jesus' argument is going. What are the opponents of Sadducees trying to do? They're trying to make resurrection look ridiculous. They're aware that Jesus teaches it. They knew that the Pharisees taught it. And they perhaps had some standard arguments, or perhaps this was a new one they had just worked up, to make resurrection look ridiculous. And the basic point of it is this, that we can imagine a situation in which, following the Old Testament law, that a brother, if his older brother died without having any children, the younger brother was to marry the widow, and the children they had, or at least the first child they had, would belong to the older brother and would be heir in his estate. And then they expand this thing to a situation in which there are seven brothers, and each of them are married to this widow, and no children, etc. One is suspicious whether such a circumstance ever occurred, but it might have. Anyway, designed to make resurrection look ridiculous. How did Jesus respond? Well, it looks to me like he leaves out some steps of his argument. But basically, his response is this, that there are two things you're mistaken about, and that is, you do not understand Scripture, and you do not understand God's power. I suspect the remark about God's power is you don't understand that God is able to raise people from the dead. What's the thing about don't understand Scripture, though? Well, my suggestion here, as I point out on our PowerPoint, is that I think Jesus' point is that resurrection is necessary for God to keep his covenant promise. What was the purpose, after all, of this command of levirate marriage, that the younger brother would marry the older brother's widow if the older brother and the widow hadn't had any children, etc.? It was to keep the older brother's property in the family, so to speak. And so it had something to do with the inheritance question, the promise that God had given to the patriarchs that they would inherit the land. If you walk back through the Old Testament passages, the promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you find that in each of these passages, Abraham is promised that he and his descendants will inherit the land. Isaac is promised that he and his descendants will inherit the land. Jacob is promised that he and his descendants will inherit the land. Now, if you think about what the Sadducees believed, those promises were broken because Abraham died without having the land. And he doesn't exist anymore in the Sadducean position. And Isaac died without inheriting the land. And he doesn't exist anymore in the Sadducean view. Same thing with Jacob, etc. And I think Jesus is pointing out, not true, because there's going to be a resurrection. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob still exist, and they still can inherit the land personally, as well as their descendants inherit. That resurrection is necessary for God to keep his covenant promise regarding the land, and that he is able to do that very thing. One last example of a controversy passage, a little different sort. In those others, we're thinking in terms of someone who we would say are the bad guys, so to speak. But in this one, we've got Mary and Martha, and both of them are followers of Jesus. We're looking at Luke 10, verses 38 through 42, pretty familiar passage, actually. Here's how it goes. Luke 10, 38. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he was said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you're worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." So Jesus' opponent, in this sense, is Martha. And what is Martha trying to do? Martha is trying to embarrass Mary to get her to help. What does Jesus do? He defends Mary. Perhaps he suggests that Martha's preparations are too elaborate. There's different ways to take verse 14, etc., but only one thing is needed. But at the least, he's certainly suggesting that Mary's priorities in sitting and listening to Jesus is in some sense more important than Martha's priorities. Martha's trying to do something good for Jesus, have a nice meal for Jesus and his disciples and the family. All good. But Mary is listening to what Jesus is teaching. And that's better in some sense. Just as Jesus can say in other circumstances, it's far better for us to do what God says than to do what our parents say, that unless we love God more than our parents or our wife or friends or anything of that sort, we'll not the end of his kingdom. We're seeing, getting something of that sort as well. He may be suggesting that if Martha were preparing a simple meal, she wouldn't need Mary's help, and she could go ahead and do that without trying to pull Mary away from what's going on here. In any case, Jesus is suggesting that Mary's concern is better. Well, that's a quick tour of a few examples of controversy passages, with my main point being this. Make sure you understand what Jesus and his opponents are arguing about. Don't just go grabbing a few words and stuffing it in some controversy today until you've seen what they're arguing about, see what the basic principles are that Jesus is operating from, see how he argues, etc., and use those both in trying to copy Jesus' example, in that we try to argue in such a way that we can reach out to our opponents and help them to see the truth is, but also that we can see how Jesus' own position and the Bible's position deals with a particular controversy that we're concerned about as well. I think if you do this, you will find that you will be more effective in understanding controversy passages and being able to handle controversies that you are involved in as well, and trying to wind up on the right side and argue the right reasons.